You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. In 1961, Newton Minow, the chairman of the Federal Communications Commission, called television a vast wasteland of game shows, formula comedies about totally unbelievable families, blood and thunder, mayhem, violence, sadism, murder, Western bad men, Western good men, private eyes, gangsters, more violence, and cartoons, and endlessly, commercials. Minow's words notwithstanding, in 1964, the SS Minow set sail on a three-hour tour on a CBS show, the tale of seven people whose three-hour tour turned into a multi-season run as castaways on Gilligan's Island. Gilligan's Island was as totally unbelievable as any sitcom Newton Minow might have objected to. But the show captured the hearts of millions of viewers and ran on and on in syndication, reunion movies, and cartoon adaptations. There was, among the castaways, a wholesome young gingham-clad beauty from Kansas named Mary Ann, who was portrayed by actress and beauty queen Dawn Wells. She was supposed to be plain compared to co-star Tina Louise's movie star, Ginger, but still, when asked Mary Ann or Ginger, many fans voted Mary Ann. Dawn Wells died in December of 2020 at the age of 82 from COVID-related illness. A few years ago, I had the opportunity to speak with Dawn Wells upon the publication of her book, What Would Mary Ann Do? Today, From the Bookshelf remembers Dawn Wells by listening back to that interview.
Are you surprised, you know, considering all the things that have changed in the world, that Gilligan's Island is still such a well-regarded program with so many fans?
Well, it's interesting because you sort of keep up with the fan level as you go. And I watched the say I was mistreated as a child, or I was an outcast, or I was a misfit. And I would come home and watch the show, and I felt I belonged. So if you as a young person watching the show, that feeling in you, that transcends. You'll want your children to watch it. You'll want your grandchildren to look at it. He created something that was timeless, I think, truly timeless.
Well, it was a wonderful show, but, you know, I mean, there were a lot of sitcoms that premiered in that season, and yet not that many are, and it didn't last, you know, for like 11 years. It was only on for three seasons, and yet, you know, it's still around. It's on DVD. It's on in reruns all every day.
We've never been off the air since 1964, and we're in 30 languages all over the world.
That's incredible, isn't it?
Well, but there's no cars or clothes or anything that tell you when it was filmed. So if you're a new crop of kids, you think it's happening for the first time.
Oh.
Smart, Sherwood Schwartz.
So I guess he was brilliant.
I guess so. I wish he'd have shared some of the finances with us, but he didn't, unfortunately.
You did, when you made your deal, there was no residuals at all, or 10 showings or something?
Oh, I mean, I think we got paid for three episodes or something, but I did a thing for CBS years ago, TV Moguls, reading my script, and it said that Sherwood Schwartz made $90 million on the Gilligan's Island reruns alone.
Wow.
And that's not Brady Bunch. It's not the regular productions. I thought he could have split a million between the seven of us. But then again, that wasn't on a contract, so there we go.
Well, in the show, was there a kind of a hierarchy among the cast? Bob Denver had been a star already. He was in Dobie Gillis as Maynard G. Krebs. And, of course, Jim Backus was a huge star. Had been in many movies like Rebel Without a Cause long before Gilligan's Island. So, and you were just, in the first season, you were just, and the rest.
They
didn't,
the rest.
Didn't even mention you. But among the cast, was there a hierarchy of people?
Well, no, I would say probably the hierarchy was Bob.
Yeah.
Because he was never a star. I mean, you never got that feeling from him. I think everybody was a hard worker. There were seven of us, pretty equal in the scripts, except for Bob and Alan. And nobody put their weight around. I was sort of in awe. I had done a lot of television for Warner Brothers, but I was very much in awe of Ginger being a movie star and watching what she looked like and how she handled herself. And I was very aware that Jim Backus shared his humor. He'd say, it'd be funnier if you try it this way or do it this way. He and Natalie used to kind of compete for exiting the scenes. And everybody was really, I guess, there for the whole, you know, trying to make the whole thing work. There wasn't any real star stuff going on.
You filmed the show indoors on a soundstage?
Well, and they built a lagoon on the outside where we would go out a couple of days a week where a boat could come in and out, and there were palm trees that were in buckets, of course. And then I love this part. There were palm trees in buckets and orchids, and then we'd leave the set, and next thing, Gunsmoke would come in and put in pine trees and tumbleweed.
That's funny.
Well, it's a little different than changing a living room into a bedroom, isn't it?
I guess there was a kind of a feeling about the show. I mean, it's kind of like unreal. I mean, they didn't, shoot for realism.
Oh, gosh, no. We would never get off the island. You know, how silly is that? It was kind of a fantasy.
Yeah.
And I think everybody's fantasy is, what would I be doing if I were on that island?
So how did you get cast in the part? I know you had done, well, you were a beauty pageant contestant, and you had done a lot of TV. You were on Maverick and Shy, a lot of Westerns, right?
Well, and I don't consider a beauty pageant. I didn't even mention it because so many people are beauty queens and come in and wanted to be in Hollywood. I was a chemistry major to begin with, and I became a theater major and said, I'll give myself 2 years, and if I don't go to work right away, I'm coming back to college, because I didn't have the dreams of being a movie star. But I looked at the both coasts, New York and Los Angeles, and New York, everybody could sing and dance, and I don't do either one. So I thought, all right, I'll give myself 2 years in Los Angeles and see if I go to work. And I went to work right away. I got my Equity card with a play with Mercedes McCambridge and Leon Ames. And then because I was a perfect ingenue and very well trained, I remember Jack Warner calling my agent and saying, I actually had an intelligent conversation with this woman. I mean, because I was a college graduate and had some knowledge, I wasn't just a beauty queen. And when it came time to audition for this character, I went and met Sherwood Schwartz in his office, and we laughed and we talked and we quipped a little bit and came back, and then they decided there were three replacements. The pilot had three other characters in it, two school teachers and a professor or something. And they were replacing those three people. And my husband was an agent, but not mine. My agent was a very small agency. And when they started getting ready to test, they told my agent they weren't going to test me the first go around. They thought I was a little too smart to play Marianne. They'd test me the next time. And my husband said, test her now or don't test her. So they actually forced the test on me, but Ethel Winant from CBS liked me, and I knew the character. I knew what she would wear. I knew how she would be. And even though there were about 300 of us auditioning for all these roles, I wasn't nervous. I was very much at ease. The last day of the auditions, Raquel Welch came in to audition for Marianne, which she should have been a Ginger, not a Marianne.
Right.
I was lucky, and nobody, you know, once we went into production, everybody said, this isn't going to last 20 minutes. And, of course, here we are. So you never know, do you? You just can't tell.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you were just kind of belittling the beauty pageant part of your career, but being in the Miss America pageant when you were in it, that was a big deal, wasn't it?
Yes, it was a big deal, but it was mainly more, it wasn't the beauty contest. They weren't in bikinis and all of that. It was the all-American girl, well-rounded, education, a talent, smart enough to answer some questions. It was a little different. I guess it was sort of the first of the first.
Yeah, right. But it was on TV, and Burt Parks was the host, and I remember all that.
Yeah, I was quite nervous about it, but you're so concentrating on the show that goes on television, you don't worry about your competition, really.
Yeah. What was your talent in the Miss America pageant?
Being from Shakespeare, I did As You Like It, where she's dressed as a boy talking to her boyfriend to see what he says about her.
Dressed as a boy? I don't think you were convincing at that, Don Wells.
Well, now, how do you know? Born yet. You wouldn't know what I'm talking about. No, you know, and all that Shakespeare in the tights and the hat and all that kind of stuff.
I bet you looked cute as a button.
Oh.
Well, hey, we're talking with Dawn Wells, and she's written a book, and it's called What Would Marianne Do? A Guide to Life. And it's a great book co-written with Steve Stinson. And the show, Gilligan's Island, of course, you know, people just love it, and it's such a marvelous show. And in your book, What Would Marianne Do?, you said that the character was like a blank slate when you became Marianne. How did you meet the challenge of creating a character there?
Like I said, when I auditioned, I sort of knew who she was and what she would be, and there was no description except she came from Kansas. So I think if you come from Kansas, you probably learned to milk a cow. You probably knew how to grow a vegetable. You probably pitched in. You weren't a little society girl with a $500 purse and all of that kind of stuff. So the basics of, and I was raised in Marianne. My mother raised me with Marianne values without even knowing it, even though I grew up in Reno, Nevada, where there was gambling and prostitution. My mother knew where I was every single minute up to the fact when I was 60 years old, she traced me to some airport in Sydney. My mother kept a real handle on me, and I wondered why I didn't run away, and why didn't I go out and get drunk, and why didn't I do all those things that kids are doing today. But I had respect for and I think that it, nowadays the families are so mixed. There's stepchildren, and there's mixed religions, and there's mixed races, and everybody has to work to keep food on the table. It's not quite that same Donna Reed upbringing that I was brought up in. You know, I think it's much harder today. That's why I kind of thought with the book, the people will say to me, the fans will say, I was abused as a child. I used to come home, and I was beaten, and the only show they'd let me watch was this one. And you see the sadness in some of the fans, and you think you really had an influence. I really had an influence. I don't know what kind of an influence the Kardashians have at this point.
Exactly, sure.
It was different then.
Well, I enjoyed the show because I thought it was well-crafted and funny.
Yes, it was funny. And Bob Denver was a genius with that physical comedy. The more I look at it, the more how he tripped and just fell and did all those things, that's a natural talent. It's like a Charlie Chaplin. You can't teach anybody that.
I always thought it was Laurel and Hardy with the skipper and
yes, it was.
Yeah, he definitely does. Alan Hale Jr. does a wonderful Oliver Hardy thing pretty much throughout the whole show.
And he was the size of my dad. And every time Alan would hug me, he'd pick me up about 4 feet off the floor, and you knew you were hugged.
Did you maintain a relationship with the other members of the cast?
Oh, yes. As a matter of fact, Natalie Schaefer and I were quite close. Bob Denver and I were very close, as was I with the professor and Alan. I think the two people that I related the least to, and it didn't mean I didn't relate, were basically Jim and Tina.
Hmm. So you and Tina were not like that? Was there some competition between you?
No, I don't think so. And that Ginger and Marianne question, I don't think even evolved till after we went off the air.
Yeah.
I was in awe. I mean, she was a movie star. She was beautiful, and I was watching everything that she did. She got us our false eyelashes. They were made of mink from New York, and she knew that the left side was the prettiest side of her face, although both of them are beautiful. But I was in awe, but very confident as an actress and where I fit. There was never any animosity. I never saw a temper tantrum. I never saw any of that. It was, I think, that read in the scripts, the way we all got along.
Yeah. Well, since you kind of created your own character, if the writers came up with something that you thought was inconsistent, would you say to them, "Oh no, Marianne wouldn't do that," or "That's not right"?
Oh, sure, I would have, but I never saw it.
Oh, uh-huh.
No, I mean they knew who we were.
One of my favorite episodes is there's a beauty pageant on the island, and they're going to choose which is the most beautiful castaway, Miss Castaway. And there seemed like there might have been a hint of romance between Marianne and the professor in that episode.
And I just wondered in the world, we didn't dare touch that with a 10-foot pole, but we used to laugh and say, if we hadn't been married, I don't know, Marianne, the professor might have run off together.
Run off to a desert island.
Yes, on our own. I could have cooked, he could have gotten telescopes, we might have been there forever.
And you've done so many things as an actress, both before and after Gilligan's Island, but you still feel this a connection with Marianne.
Well, you know, she made me famous, so to speak. I mean, I could have done a million Shakespeare roles and things around the country that you might never have known who I was. So it kind of put me in front of the public. It upped my price a little bit. And it also gave me a challenge because people would say, are you kidding? Marianne playing that role? No way. I mean, it took me 2 years to even get him to let me do vagina monologues. So it was a curse and a blessing at the same time. That's why I went back to the stage, so I wouldn't be just typed. Of course, I couldn't play Marianne now in a million years. But still, you know, you kind of try to break that image a little bit to show that you can do more than just that character.
We're all shocked that Marianne knows the word vagina to begin with.
Oh, that's right.
Well, but you actually played
the cows and sheep on the farm. She knows about that stuff.
you actually played Mrs. Howell recently, too. Is that
yes,
right?
I did in the musical, and boy, it was really funny. I'll tell you a story. I don't sing. And I said to the director, well, Mrs. Howell doesn't sing. Oh, yes, she does. I said, no, she doesn't. She would talk these words. No, she doesn't. So there was one little cute song, oh, it's good to be richer, it's better to be richest, or something. But then there's a love song at the end of the musical with she and Thurston. That's quite a lovely ballad. Well, believe me, I had a hard time with it. And I remember closing night, Barry Williams and I are dancing cheek to cheek, and he's going, he's humming the, trying to give me the note while I'm singing in my ear because I was so off key.
I don't believe you, but it's possible.
It's true. You should hear me. He's a jolly good fellow. In the first episode, Sherwood said, please just keep still. You are getting everybody off key. And I did a movie called Winterhawk that I was very proud of, and I was playing a missionary. And the director said, now, you're going to lead the rest of the congregation in Amazing Grace. I said, no, Charlie, I can't. He said, yes, of course you can. So he started me, he said, you're right, you can't. And it was, you know, taking place in the 1850s, and I had this long skirt on. So we're in the middle of a field. He asked me to spread my legs about 2 feet. He puts a girl underneath me, between my legs, puts my skirt over her head. I mouth the words, and she's singing Amazing Grace.
Now I have to watch for that scene. That's incredible. That's taking lip sync to a new...
That's right, it is. We don't talk about that.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and this week we are remembering the late Dawn Wells. She passed away at the age of 82 from a COVID-related illness in December of 2020. She portrayed Marianne on Gilligan's Island.
Any plans for the 50th anniversary of Gilligan's Island?
Well, you know, it's kind of funny. A couple of years ago they talked about a movie, and those writers are gone, and that's out of the picture. I don't know. I would think that I produced a movie of the week for CBS. I would think since it was on CBS, they do some kind of a memorial or something, or they've talked about the film. But I've been in the midst of my book, and I haven't heard a word. I'm astounded. But, you know, making a movie out of something, it doesn't usually work, does it?
No. I mean, I don't like those movies that are – I don't care much for, I don't know, Bewitched or whatever.
You can't capture the chemistry.
No.
Get that Gilligan and the Skipper chemistry. You can't get... I just think that's almost impossible.
Yeah, no, it's not. It's not possible. I mean, and you don't need to do it because the show is still in existence and every episode is available and they're all great. And just watch them again. That's what I say. That's how I'm going to celebrate.
I put my short shorts up for sale this year.
Oh!
I don't have any children and I start thinking, my God, it's the 50th year. When I croak, they're going to say, where are they? So I thought, well... they were the first short shorts on television. I designed them. Couldn't show my navel.
Yeah, you said that you couldn't show your navel. Did they tell you that? No navels?
No navel, no cleavage. And Sherwood used to say, oh, I had such a hard day today. I had to go back to the set 3 times. You could see Marianne's navel when she was walking. Ginger's cleavage was showing. We were only allowed to show it for 30 seconds or something. I mean, it was quite a deal. And now think what's going on.
Really? Now you can't have a show without a navel. You must have someone's navel in every...
If you aren't naked, they don't want you.
I wonder if Barbara Eden had that same edict.
Well, Barbara and I were very good friends at the time, and her waistband came up higher than my shorts. And I designed the shorts because I'm little, short. Yeah. My legs aren't very long, and Tina's legs are 6 feet tall. So I curved them up on the side of my legs, and I curved them down at the waist so my midriff would look longer, and then it just kind of scooped up over my navel and scooped down again.
Did you wear the same? You must have had more than one pair of shorts. There must have been dozens of pair.
Well, probably just 2 or 3, because I was in that gingham dress a lot, too.
Yeah, oh, I love that.
Yeah. Where that is. Well, at least I had the shorts. I don't know how I got them home. We were picked up for the next season. We were going to go to Hawaii and shoot, and then... they canceled Gunsmoke, and Mrs. Paley said, no, don't cancel it. So he put it back on and canceled us.
Oh.
Well, oh. I lost my father, got a divorce, and the series was canceled all in the same month.
Oh, my gosh. That was a bad month for you.
It was, but I don't know anything about tranquilizers, so I got through it.
Yeah, I guess. But, you know, it wasn't truly the end because, like we've said, it's lasted. I have fond memories of a cartoon show you did where you played both Marianne and Ginger.
Gilligan's Planet, yeah. I would like to see the Gilligan's Island in a foreign language. It would really be interesting to see it in Japanese or in French or something.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know what you'd do with a song, but it'd be fun to see all those little... however somebody would say it. I think it'd be fun.
It seemed to me, I mean, I was just a kid, but it seemed to me that you took that cartoon show seriously.
Oh, sure. Well, I was excited to do both voices, too.
Yeah. And you...
I was kind of a... me.
It was kind of schizophrenic of you to be both...
Oh, yes. Do Ginger really well when the lights are low. No. I didn't say that. Mrs. Howell did.
Oh. Now let's talk about your book a little. What would Marianne do? You were saying in this book that you would like to just talk to everybody, but since you can't, you're talking to them through this book. And I don't want people to think it's a memoir exactly of your life, although that's part of it. But it's really an advice column.
Yes, and you being a male and having read it, I think it's a light read. I think it's kind of it makes some sense. It's kind of who I am. And how I was raised, and what I think I would be doing if I were a parent, and I think it's kind of something you share with your daughter or your son, or you give it as a Christmas gift to somebody who's not necessarily having trouble with their children. But today, both parents work. It's multiracial, multi families all trying to live together. It's not as easy. And if you've got a child that you've married a husband who has a daughter whose ex-wife doesn't believe in manners and she's eating with her fingers and you're sitting down at a table, there's going to be chaos to begin with. So how do we all make that work? And I think values and listening and back to the old ABCs, kindness and being polite and being the best you can be. One of my chapters, if you don't fail, fail, fail again. I mean, you don't just try once. What do you think these basketball players shoot? And if they don't make a basket, that's the end of it. So I think we need to kind of revive that in our youth a little bit. It isn't just $500 purses and red carpet. There's a lot more to who you're going to be 10 years later. And I was hoping that maybe that book would instill some of that without preaching.
Well, it does that. And you also talk a bit about beauty, and you're a very beautiful woman, and you're still an incredibly beautiful woman based on these pictures that I'm looking at. And
well, thank you for that, but it's all paint. I mean, there's a little natural bone structure, but not a lot. But you need to learn, if you're a young lady, you need to learn what your best features and what you're grooming. And clean hair is always the best, and nails that aren't dirty, and find out what's the most becoming to you. I went to Rush's every single day, which means I went and saw what they filmed yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
Analyze that. No, that's not a good color on me. No, that's the wrong hairdo on me. Like I was a package that I was selling rather than, well, I'd rather wear that. And I'm still very aware of that, what's the most flattering. And there's nothing wrong with that. It doesn't mean vanity that's all you're thinking about, but we should be the best we can be in everything we do, in our study habits, in our looks, in our relationship with people. I mean, I think that the world would be a better place if we all were the best we were.
You talk a bit about friendship and about choosing your friends, and you make a correlation between, you know, being stuck on an island with some people, as in Gilligan's Island, and in choosing your friends. You want to talk about that a little?
Well, I do, and I've had friends from high school that I've known since first grade. We're still close. I went to a women's college in Missouri where two of my very closest friends, we met when we were 17. I believe that the core of you goes on if you're there for the right reason. If you're there to make a splash or have to be with somebody rich or have to be invited to these things and that things, there's no stability inside of you. And I was really raised by a good mother. I really was. And my parents were divorced. And my mother and father were friends. And my mother and stepmother were friends. And I just had two families that loved me. I am blessed with that. I get so many fans that say I was just so mistreated and you were my only family. And that breaks my heart. Because it isn't easy today. But if there's love in that household and respect for each other, you'd be surprised how you turn out.
Was not having children yourself just something that happened? Did you want to have children?
Of course I wanted to have children, and I couldn't do it while I was shooting the series. That wasn't an issue until the series was over. And then I got a divorce, and I certainly wasn't going to have a baby not married. I moved to Nashville. I fell in love with someone. I moved to Nashville, but we didn't live together. I don't believe in that unless you're married. But I helped raise his children, and I'm very proud of how they turned out. And my father and stepmother adopted two children when I was 14 and 15, and they lost him when they were just in high school, so I helped raise them as well. So I've been a mother, so to speak, from afar, but I know I recognize a good one when I see one. I have a friend in Nashville who's the best mother in the world, and I can see that. So I didn't get a chance to do it myself, but children have always been a part of my life.
Dawn Wells rose to fame as Marianne on Gilligan's Island, and she died in December of 2020 at the age of 82.
Just sit right back and you'll hear a tale of a fateful trip that started from this tropic port aboard this tiny ship. The mate was a mighty sailing man, the skipper brave and sure. 5 passengers set sail that day for a 3-hour tour, a 3-hour tour. The weather started getting rough, the tiny ship was tossed. If not for the courage of the fearless crew, the minnow would be lost. The minnow would be lost. The ship's aground on the shore of this uncharted desert isle, with Gilligan, the skipper too. The millionaire and his wife, the movie star, the professor and Marianne, here on Gilligan's Island.
Bonnie Morris joins me now, a professor at UC Berkeley. She's the author of 19 books, including Sound Waves of Feminism, The Women's Music Movement, The Feminist Revolution, The Struggle for Women's Liberation, and Women's History for Beginners. Michelle Obama is a fan. Bonnie Morris, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you very much. And I'd say that the Sound Waves is a recent article. The book is under direction right now, but it's something that is clearly linked to what you do, looking at the medium of sound and how the messages of women's history or activism reach fans almost accidentally over the air.
How do you mean almost accidentally?
Well, I'm interested in the women's music movement. And I work as the archivist for Olivia Records, which started in 1973 in Washington, D.C., and is now Olivia Travel. Regrettably, Olivia Cruises is just a little bit grounded right now. But the music continues. It's more or less warehoused at the offices in San Francisco, and one of my jobs was to organize it. What interests me is that a lot of the sound of the women's movement of the 70s, 80s, 90s is still being played on independent radio stations. And everything from some of the very beautiful grassroots folk music, which you play and which I enjoy so much, and the music that was produced by independent companies like Olivia and Redwood, all of that became a means of radicalizing women when it was played on local and college stations. In short, you didn't have to leave your house and go to a radical concert to encounter the music.
Well, you know, Bonnie Morris, I've had Pulitzer Prize winners on the show and National Book Award winners and Oscar winners and Grammy winners and Tony Award winners. But you're the first person on the show who has had a book on Oprah's list.
Oh, that was an amazingly fortuitous thing. This is the book. I'm just holding it, up. The Feminist Revolution. What was fantastic about that, I was actually approached by a lovely editor who had read Women's History for Beginners and said, I like your style. I want to do a book that's specifically about the women's liberation movement of the 60s, 70s. I want you to write the American part. We're going to have a woman in England write some chapters about the actions that took place in England and Ireland. And we're going to get the Smithsonian to publish it. And we'll have images, graphics, photos, and you can research those, but we'll help you with the art permissions. And boy, that took about a year to do, a year and a half. There's 9 chapters with 9 sidebars. So we crammed in issues on sports and war and peace and women running for office and the women's bookshop movement, the role of religion, Black women's identity and activism. And in the end, it really was featured in Oprah magazine as 10 titles you must read for Women's History Month. And I was also filmed for C-SPAN at the Politics and Prose bookshop in DC, which is a big famous author site. That was just an astounding experience. The book has been translated into French. It's on sale in Paris. And I received letters from all over the world with very probing questions, including some wonderful contact from a lot of guys asking how they could raise a daughter in a world where there were still many threats against the safety and confidence of girls. The experience of being part of the Smithsonian was very positive. I went and did a book signing, and that was an amazing day. I was seated at the end of a long hall so that if you walked up to the Smithsonian bookshop, I was outside at a table. And it would take a good bit of a walk for tourists to come toward the bookshop and see the title of the book that was being signed outside. So a woman came up to me and said, "Hi, do you hate men? Do you want to destroy the family? Because that's what I think of when I hear the word feminist." And I had to think really quickly and go, "Why no? You know, this book is about women running for office in the All-American Girls Baseball League and the first Asian American congresswoman, Patsy Mink, and what she did for girls in education. And I think we're all very enthusiastic about those things." And her response was, "Oh," but in this position, when many people will take out either their hostility toward what they think the movement represents or their desperate need for me to be an oracle telling them how to raise a perfect daughter, you know, you keep your face neutral and smiling so that people don't see the panic in your brain. How am I going to spin this now? And that's very normal in my experience. Probably one of the most challenging times was I was an in-depth author profile. That was a very long program. It was something like 2 or 3 hours in the studio, and it became this big C-SPAN film. That guy was interviewing me, book Women's History for Beginner for Michelle Obama, who later sent me a fan letter. But while I was on the air explaining what those chapters were all about, and I'm wearing headphones, and they had people call in, and a guy called in and basically said I was going to burn in hell for all eternity. And I was still on camera, so I had to just keep my eyes from rolling back in my head.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking with music archivist and author of 19 books, Bonnie Morris. Bonnie Morris, how did First Lady Michelle Obama learn about your work?
What happened with getting the book to the First Lady was that very wonderfully, the Obama administration honored Women's History Month by screening a film called Movers, which was then on PBS as a documentary about the women who had achieved during the feminist movement. The White House film screening room showed that documentary, and they invited women's studies students from around D.C. to come in, as many as could fit in a little theater. So my classroom was invited from both Georgetown and George Washington University. I was teaching Intro to Women's Studies at both schools. So off we went, going through security to the White House screening room, where we were received by Valerie Jarrett, who was, of course, advisor to President Obama. And at the end of the hour, I gave her copies of my book for Sasha and Malia Obama. And about a year later, I received this huge envelope from the White House. I thought I was under arrest or investigation. What could it be? And here was this beautiful note from Michelle Obama, which I have framed on the wall. So this is to say that I am not rich or famous or tenured, but that my work has actually reached some fairly high-powered women and made an impression, which has been intensely gratifying. And based on the email I get year-round, it's also struck a chord with a lot of people who see me as sufficiently friendly and approachable that they can either unload their rage or their questions. And that's okay. It's okay to be that person.
And so you write nonfiction, academic work, you write fiction, mm-hmm. and you write poetry.
Yes. I have a fiction series with Bywater Books, Sappho's Bar and Grill, and the sequel, Sappho's Overhead Projector. I had an idea initially behind this fiction series. If you're an avid reader, you may recall that quite some years ago, a well-known feminist writer named Phyllis Chesler did a book called Letters to a Young Feminist. And she was basically trying to pass along some wisdom and advice from her era to the next. It was instantly followed by Dinesh D'Souza's Letters to a Young Conservative, as though there couldn't be a standalone book of generational conversation and feminism without a counter release. And then a whole bunch of people piled on and did Letters to a Young whatever. Well, I was thoughtful. And I thought, you know, I don't want to write to the next generation and tell them what to do from the left or the right. I really want to write to my foremothers and say, help, what do we do now? How did you negotiate this baloney or other B words, you know, that's going on in society? What did you do to stay steady? And then I suddenly had a light bulb go over my head and I thought, wow, man, what if I did a book where our narrator, who is me, meets every Saturday night for a year with some ghost from the past and, you know, you have dinner and you talk about an issue that's just been unresolved, like equal pay or whatever. And for each famous woman from the past, there could be appropriate music and appropriate food for that time period. And by the time I had this fleshed out, it turned into fiction. And I conceived the idea of a haunted lesbian bar where the narrator would just go for a drink after work. But the drinks were magical and they could take you into the past. So the storyline is about a kind of magic bartender who has potions that open a portal to experiences with activists from the 19th and early 20th century. And our heroine gets to meet Harriet Tubman and Amelia Earhart and the players of the All-American Girls Baseball League, who I obviously am infatuated with because I write about them all the time. Anyway, the first book was nominated for a foreword award and was very well received to critical reviews. So I wrote a sequel, which is set in the Library of Congress and is much more about modern angst. So many books are being, frankly, turned to pulp or shredded as we move to digital. And I wrote from the perspective of the books. How they missed being held and touched and paged and were terrified of shreddy. And that book has been very popular with librarians. And I researched with some friends who are librarians, what's the process of a book being destined for the shredder and how could you save them and where do they go? And is there a magic shelf somewhere for all the unwanted books that some child really would love, like kind of like now I'm thinking sort of like Rudolph's Island of Unwanted Toys. But in my case, it was books that have barely been read from women's history before being consigned to the rubbish heap, frankly. So, yeah, that was sort of typical of my modus operandi, where if I'm working on one academic book, I usually have a creative book at the same time. So if I get sick of one, I go to the other and always come to one project sort of fresh. So I'll do academic research in poetry or academic research in fiction or an article that's painful and controversial with something that's frisky and sentimental. And I think that's a good yin-yang approach to the writing life.
Well, we've been talking with Bonnie Morris, and while we were talking, she wrote a book. She's written 19 books so far.
If only, man.
And it's really been a pleasure to talk with you, and thank you for visiting us on From the Bookshelf.
I am really grateful, and your work has been a great pleasure for me to encounter. This is a community that is so nurturing to artists for all the right reasons.
Occasionally, I get a chance to drop by Good Morning Monterey Bay, the morning program here on KSCO with Rosie, and talk about books. Here's a snippet of one of my recent appearances on that show.
Because you get quite a lot of notable people, you know, you get the A-listers. Do you get nervous when you get A-listers on, or is it that you've been doing this for so long, it doesn't matter?
I don't think nervous, but I get excited, you know. I'm always excited because I've read it's the greatest thing of being able to do my show is that, you know, I read a book. I'm sure a lot of you have the same thing. You read a book and you think, God, I'd love to talk to the author. And then I get to do that.
Yeah.
And that's really, especially with, if I get a chance to talk to authors over a period of years where I follow their work and you know, and really get to know them, it's really a, just guess, it's just so great. I love that.
Yeah, no, that's very good. So, and what's the name of the book again?
It's called Time Between, My Life as a Bird, Burrito Brother, and Beyond. And it's a really well-written book, and Chris Hillman wrote it by himself. There's no co-author. It's just...
A man of many talents, obviously.
Yeah, I'll tell you one thing about him. You know, he's worked with some of the most insufferable people in the history of music, like David Crosby and Graham Parsons. And yet he has nothing bad to say about any of these people.
Now that's classy.
Yeah, he's a very nice guy.
Good, good. And that's this Monday night then?
Yeah, that's right. One of my authors that's been on my show a few times, and I've followed her work, is Jennifer Keeshan Armstrong. And I'm sure I've mentioned her to you before because she's written several biographies of television shows. She wrote a book about the Mary Tyler Moore Show. Then she wrote a book about Sex in the City. And then she wrote a book about Seinfeld, where she tells the story of those shows and how they fit into American popular culture. She's a very talented writer. She used to write for Entertainment Weekly. And I just got her new book, which is not coming until early next year, but... You know, that's one of the other perks of being the host of From the Bookshelf is they send me lots of great books. And I haven't read it. It's sitting right here. I was like, this is the book I'm looking forward to reading next. It's called When Women Invented Television, The Untold Story of the Female Powerhouses Who Pioneered the Way We Watch Today.
Yeah, that's probably true.
Yeah, she focuses on the lives of four interesting women, including Betty White.
And Lucille Ball, too. She was an early television person with Desilu Productions.
Absolutely. What? Oh, sure. She was, you know, huge. And in fact, I just read this other book. Do I have time to tell you about another one?
Yeah.
I just read this other book by David Thompson. I don't know if you're familiar with
the
David
film
Thompson.
Guy.
That's right.
He's incredible.
A really interesting British film guy. And I just read a couple of books by him since I've talked to you last. And one of them is called A Biography, Television, A Biography. And it's a very interesting book about... He's so astute.
Yes.
And he's also very opinionated. And he wrote, in 1975, he wrote this book called The Biographical Dictionary of Film.
Yes.
It's like the most opinionated book ever written. And but he's... His opinions are interesting, and he also kind of have a stream of consciousness way of writing. He wrote a book a few years ago that I highly recommend called How to Watch a Movie.
A few moments with Rosie on Good Morning Monterey Bay. You can catch me on that show every couple of weeks on Wednesday. That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.